Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Delighted to be with you on this Wednesday afternoon. Two great guests for you. Darren did it again. Darren has been just killing it with the scheduling. Okay, so we got Carla Broussard, second hour. We're going to talk about, well, a little thing we like to call tolerance, and we're going to talk about it in the context of the truth. The tolerance is like a magic word in our society today, but where does the truth fit in with being tolerant of others? Looking forward to that second hour. This hour, we haven't talked to him in a long time, and it's wonderful to welcome him back. Father Tad Poholcek, and you know that when Father Tad is here, then what we are doing that hour is a little something called bioethics. If you have questions regarding bioethics, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Bioethics can include anything from beginning of life and end of life issues. It can include treatments for things like infertility or various other illnesses. It could also include kind of future things like what about cloning and that kind of stuff. Bioethics is a wide open field. In some ways, wide open to things that I'm sure that most moral people would prefer it not be wide open to. In many other ways, doing unbelievable, magnificent things in curing diseases and taking care of people. Again, if you have questions on bioethics, you are very, very welcome to call. You probably couldn't get a better guy to talk to than Father Tad Poholcek. The number 888-318-7884. If you don't know, Father Tad is a priest of the Diocese of Fall River, Massachusetts, and he's the director of education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center. He holds a doctorate in neuroscience from Yale University. And I have to tell you, when we here at Catholic Answers get tough questions from people who need an answer as far as bioethics goes, we are never even the slightest bit hesitant to send them to the National Catholic Bioethics Center. It is probably among the very top, the very best bioethics places of thinking, and especially in assisting people in being moral in the application of bioethics in the world. Maybe with the Vatican as well. Father Tad Poholcek, thanks for being with us.
Great to be able to join you. Thank you.
Well, are you as good as I said you are there at the National Catholic Bioethics
Center? Well, that was quite a build up, you know. Yeah. I hope we come in close to that. We certainly try to.
You better now, huh? Well, I imagine in your line of work, It's an everyday thing. Summer doesn't probably bring much of a break. Are there things happening? Are there news items, things out there that you look to now with particular concern? Is there anything that you're looking to with particular hope at the moment in the field of biology and in bioethics?
Well, I would say you're right that summertime doesn't really change the pace of work for us. We provide a free consultation service, and we find during the summer it's just as busy as during any other time of the year. And people can actually contact us at that free consultation service either by going to our website, which is ncbcenter.org, and there's a drop-down menu for consultations, or they can call us and leave a voicemail and one of our ethicists will get back to them. So, you know, we do a fair amount of consultations of that type, addressing practical questions. And to sort of put a bigger sheen onto this and go towards your question, I would say that I think the transgender area is an area of escalating concern. Yeah. We see, you know, a great deal of discussion around this now that we didn't see even 5 years ago. So that's one area that really has been changing quite quickly. And I mean, when you ask in terms of areas of hope or new directions that we really haven't seen as much in the past as we do now, I must say that I think some of what I see coming out of this administration in terms of pro-life initiatives that I have been, you know, very surprised and see that as a sign of hope in terms of, you know, even efforts to defund Planned Parenthood and other pro-life initiatives, it seems to me that there is a certain determination there that has not been present in recent years in our government.
Yeah.
So, you know, I see those as signs of hope.
Well, you know, and that's wonderful because we need a little hope in that area. As to the transgender thing, one almost feels like the regrets that are about to manifest, you know, over the course of the next 5 or 10 years or so, people's stories of tremendous regret, you wince at them, but it almost, you almost feel like in our society, until people have actual, what I would say are victims of this ideology who they can identify with and say, no, that's why this is wrong, I don't think that we're going to turn back.
I think that's probably true. It's sadly true that that's the case. There's a certain sense in which we have to experience the full weight of the consequences of erroneous moral decision-making. I mean, I'm also amazed, just going back to the abortion arena, that we've had so many decades now of legal abortion. And certainly there are women out there who are stepping up and saying, here's my story. You know, I was just reading one earlier this morning. And that, I think, is incredibly powerful when they say, you know, what this meant in terms of a disruption to their life and how much they regret what they have done. So I think the same is true in the transgender arena. We're going to have people who, some of whom go partly down the path and maybe only do what they refer to as top surgery or maybe only hormonal treatments, and then, you know, further down the line, step back and say, gee, why did I do this? And this was something harmful. There's already a number of stories and individuals who are in actively making known these kinds of events and how they've affected their own lives. And that's a hopeful sign as well. Some of those testimonies are incredibly compelling when you get the chance to hear them. Individuals like Walt Heyer, for example, who, you know, is now traveling really on the speaking circuit and giving that firsthand testimony. And he did both top and bottom surgery and, you know, bitterly regretted it later. So somehow I think we have to go down this road a certain distance. And, you know, people are not sometimes open to hearing it in the simplicity and clarity of moral truth that we wish they would be. It reminds me of a comment that one of my uncles once made, which was that every parent wants to save their children from making the same mistakes that they made.
Yeah.
But so often it seems like the kids have to make the mistakes themselves before they actually learn the yeah, you know, value of certain teachings.
888-318-7884 is our number. Father Tad Boholcik is our guest this hour, and we're here to talk about bioethics this hour. If you have a question in bioethics, it does not have to be on the topic of the transgender movement. It could be on beginning of life, end of life, or middle of life issues. 888-318-7884. I suppose part of the feeling of that people are being abused in the transgender movement comes from, it's hard not to shake the sense that there's a lot of quack scientists, science involved in this. And maybe you don't use pejorative words like that, but it just seems like a lot of quackery.
Well, I think there is a problem with the science, and I think that people lose touch with the fact that scientists can also be drawn into certain fads, if you will, passing fashions almost, which are deemed politically correct at a particular time and are, when viewed later down the road historically, can be seen to be very, very unreasonable. But when you're in the midst of those fads, it's sometimes hard to see straight. So I do think that scientifically here, there's a lot of kind of scrambling around now to try to find sound scientific bases for saying, oh, well, if a person says, a male says that he's actually a female, that we should therefore accord him, you know, full belief in that claim, et cetera. But it really is a lot of scrambling and searching around for justifying motives rather than the science presenting itself. I mean, part of what's done here is people reach into a different arena, which is the arena that we call intersex, where some individuals, very, very, very tiny number, are born with ambiguous genitalia or with other kind of dual sex characteristics, and they try to draw that all the way out and say, in virtue of that tiny, tiny little fraction of individuals who are like that, that means all the rest of us, if we make a declaration tomorrow that we want to change sexes, that this has to be, you know, A-OK.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of scrambling that I'm referring to that I think is happening on a larger scale than it should be within the arena of the medical profession and science more broadly.
Is there, to the person who, say, from childhood has a kind of fixation that does not, I don't know if fixation is the right word, but I'll just use it, that I'm a girl, not a boy, or I'm a boy, not a girl, and this persists into adulthood, is there any evidence that this might actually be connected to a neurological maybe deficit or a neurological problem, so that the person really is completely innocent of it, and it's not a choice by any means, but it's also they're just not manifesting mentally the truth about themselves?
Well, to say, you know, are there neurological bases, that's a very nuanced question, because when we ask why is my brain the way it is and your brain the way it is, some of that is, of course, genetic. Some of it is also developmental, how you grew up in your mother's womb. Some of it is also environmental. So, for example, when individuals suffer heavy-duty traumas of different kinds, this will affect brain behavior and even potentially function in some cases. And structure maybe as well. Brain structure even can be, you know, modified by very, very traumatic events. So, I mean, the question of, is there some neurological correlate to transgender phenomenon? It's a hard one to answer with direct clarity there. But again, when we go back to the testimony of many individuals who are struggling with this, some of them will identify events early in their childhood. You know, I mentioned Walt Heyer earlier, and he gives a remarkable testimony. There's actually 2 half-hour videos on YouTube by him where he tells his whole story. And at one point when he was 3 years old, his grandmother dressed him in a purple chiffon dress and marched him around the house and told him how beautiful he looked, as if he were a little girl, and told him not to tell anyone else that she was doing this. So, you know, you can imagine the effect that something like that has. Later, he also mentions that he underwent sexual abuse a little further along in his life. But that also, that event, threw a wrench into the works for him and was partially contributory to his then later transgender meanderings that actually led to him doing all the surgeries and everything before he regretted and later kind of came back to his senses around the issue. But, you know, each story will be, I think, different around this. I don't think one can generalize too broadly. But you know, if you when you ask, are there neurological kind of elements here? I mean, yes, our brains are so critical to who we are, there's likely to be some kind of connection, and it may be related to early events that also transpired.
Father Tad Poholchik is our guest. He's the Director of Education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Lots of folks are on the line for you, Father, so while I assure you, callers, when we come back from the break, I will get to your calls. If you have any questions about bioethics, about how to treat human lives, human bodies, or maybe some other aspect of the biological world, give us a call, 888-318-7884. Right back after this.
This is Dr. Scott Hahn, and stay tuned for more Catholic Answers Live.
New on EWTN Radio, The Church Alive. Yes, St. Monica, who I think is one of those great role models for so many mothers today.
My mother passed on to eternal life 8 years ago on the Feast of St. Monica. And you know, what a powerful example for me, because I know she prayed me back to the church.
The Church Alive with Brian Patrick, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and Father Thomas Petri. Saturday at 7 a.m. and 1 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Hey, we still got a whole bunch of history stuff on sale. The Deep In History Sale continues at shop.catholic.com. Dozens of great CDs, books, DVDs, all on sale. Just go to the shop and click on the Deep In History banner to check out the deals. Special pricing actually on all these items ends on Sunday. This hour, we're talking bioethics with Father Tad Boholcik, who we are always delighted to have with us because he is the man with the answers. He works. He's the education director at the National Catholic Bioethics Center. And Father, a bunch of calls for you. Shall we go to the phones?
Absolutely.
All right. Let's start with Gregory in Queens, New York. Gregory, your question for Father Boholcik.
Hello. Yes. The beginning of life question. I am made up of certain number of cells. At some point in my history, I had half as many and half as many before that, and I can trace that back to one single cell that I understand. So my question is, how do I understand, when does life begin for a person who is an identical twin?
Okay, this is a great question, Gregory. I think that there is there's a certain type of affirmation here that can be made that's important, which is that it still remains the case that each of us, even in the situation of identical twinning, can identify a single cell, which we refer to as a zygote, as the authentic starting point. So the issue here, I think, that you're raising is, well, what about when you can speak about individuation that has occurred, such that we can now say for sure there are two individuals, each distinct from the other. And even that question is not totally simple, because certainly there's a point in the pregnancy beyond which twinning is no longer possible. And my understanding is that that's somewhere close to 2 weeks. But prior to that point, you can have the early human embryo break into two separate entities that will result in identical twins. And of course, when that separation occurs, then you are dealing with two distinct individuals. But part of the reason I say this is not something that is sort of totally clear is we've all heard of conjoined twins. And these are individuals who, when that splitting began of the embryo, it didn't go to completion, and parts of their bodies remain joined to each other. And there are a number of famous individuals, we see them on TV, Discovery Channel, and so on, who even live this way. They have such significant sharing of organs in their bodies, but they have definitely two distinct heads, and that allows you to say, well, in that case, there are two individuals certainly present. So this is an interesting area when we talk about when is there individuation. And it does appear that, you know, on some level we're going to have to affirm the need for neural tissue, for brain tissue to develop separately, because there are some types of twins that are joined together actually at the head. And if they share too much brain tissue, those babies are always born dead. They do not survive. So it appears there's sort of a limit condition here. You may be able to share parts of your liver and, you know, parts of your abdomen and other things, but you're not going to be able to share your brain. Once you get there, you can only share tiny, tiny little bits of it. And if you actually have more of that shared, then you don't have two individuals who survive, but you have a human organism that ends up invariably dying. So I don't know if that's helpful. I hope it gives you some sense here that when you become an individual, there is going to be some kind of relationship to the fact that you have your own brain.
Yes, yeah, helpful.
All right. So, Gregory, thank you very, very much. Again, we're talking bioethics this hour with Father Tad Poholczyk. We go now to Iltyd in Wales. That's the Wales across the water, Iltyd?
Yes, that is, yes.
All right. Well, very happy to have you. Your question for Father.
Hello, Father. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Iltyd.
Good. Yes, I work with loads of students who work with a student who work with... working biology, and they really struggle sometimes with cloning. Could you give a good Catholic response with how to deal with cloning, really?
Yes, I think actually this connects a little bit to the previous question, in the sense that a lot of times when we think about cloning, especially of humans, our impulse may be to say, well, this seems so radical and unnatural that some people even ask the question, well, would a cloned individual have a soul of their own? That's a question that I get all the time. It's amazing how, you know, universal that sentiment is, but it's also completely false. I mean, in the sense that what is a clone? A clone is an identical twin of somebody else. And it's a twin that is not made the way that Mother Nature does it. Mother Nature does it, as we just mentioned, by embryo splitting, typically. But when you do cloning, you're doing some other manipulations that involve transferring a nucleus out of one cell into a woman's egg and manufacturing, as it were, a human embryo. And that human embryo will have the characteristics of the original donor cell. So it's a kind of sneaky way around, if you will, to make an identical twin of somebody. So Dolly the sheep was a genuine sheep clone. And, you know, to the extent that we talk about animals having animal-type souls, meaning animal-ordering principles, Dolly the sheep most certainly did have that type of sheep soul. And she was a real sheep, not some kind of phantasm or unreal, copy. She was a genuine sheep for her entire life. So similarly, when human cloning occurs, I mean, it has already occurred in the laboratory, and when those clones were produced, they were not allowed to grow and be born. They were terminated in those laboratories. The laboratory in particular, there's one in Oregon that has been doing work on this. But when those clones are not terminated and are placed into a woman's uterus and are born, we will see that they are normal children. Children, you know, like any other child with a soul, genuine human beings, but who were kind of manipulated into being through these technical procedures of cloning. So I think it's helpful to frame it as cloning produces identical twins, but just not the same way that Mother Nature does, but by another kind of workaround approach.
Iltyd, how does that all strike you?
Oh, that's very good. I was just trying to work out because what I've got a Catholic student who asked me is saying, would God's grace be bestowed upon that clone? And I'm like, well, yes, of course it does. But it's like trying to find a good, solid answer to that because there are scientists going, oh, come on now, come on. Tell me the real answer. I'm like, come on.
Well, it sounds like if we're talking about an identical twin, and as Father said, a real human being, man, God's grace is just pouring out all over them, especially if they will be baptized. Thanks, Hilton. Thanks very much for the call. Father Tad Pohlchik is our guest. We're talking bioethics. If you've got a question, 888-31-TRUTH is the number.
This is Bishop James Conley of the Diocese of Lincoln. Keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Turns out that today, as back then, this question has a lot of different answers. So many groups want to appropriate Jesus, tweaking his identity until he looks and sounds just like one of them. But then you no longer have the Lord, says apologist Trent Horn. You have an imposter. In his new groundbreaking book, Counterfeit Christ, Trent exposes 18 phony versions of Jesus that we encounter today, helping you to recognize the fakes when you see them, explain why they're phony, and make a case for the full truth and beauty of who Jesus is, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Order your copy of Counterfeit Christ today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
I'm Gloria Purvis.
And I'm Deacon Harold. The Morning Glory team discusses cohabitation is not commitment.
Tomorrow morning, 7 Eastern. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Bioethics, our topic this hour. If you have a question on any aspect of bioethics, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Our guest is Father Tad Pohlchik, who is himself both a priest and a neuroscientist, and he is the director of education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Many, many calls for Father this hour, so we will try to just keep moving. Mihov in Boston, Massachusetts, you are up next. Are you there with us?
Yes, hello.
Hello,
Hello?
Hello. Thank you for your call and your question for Father.
Okay, so I have a question that's pretty specific and a bit practical because that's something I was thinking about because I'm a researcher. And so what would be Catholic ethical position on developing system that would save babies born, let's say, 10 weeks after conception, because this would open many good things, but it would also open really many places that could be misused, like making babies industrialists, let's call it like that.
Yeah, right.
So, because that would save babies that are born way earlier than they are now, around 20 weeks. That would be able to save really early, but this other side is something that scares me, so that's why I was thinking.
Okay, Father, what about artificial wombs?
Well, it's a very good question. It's actually an active question in the sense that there are researchers in Philadelphia who are developing this. They're doing it with sheep, where they deliver lambs early, before their normal due date, and place them into these sophisticated kind of Ziploc bags, which have different fluids and tubes that are then providing nourishment, and they are allowing these little lambs to grow, and this is a kind of artificial womb that they are trying to standardize and make work. So what about if this kind of thing were possible with humans? Well, I would say in principle, speaking ethically, the goal here, insofar as it is to provide a way to save vulnerable human lives, maybe a child that would be lost through an early miscarriage, for example, that there's not going to be a fundamental moral problem. We use incubators now for preemies, and we see this as, you know, a wonderful blessing that allows us to lower the limit of viability as the years pass. So I think as these incubators become more and more sophisticated, it will be possible to move, as Mijo was saying, from 24 weeks to 22, and, you know, still earlier into pregnancies where you'll actually be able to save children who might need that due to some complication related to the pregnancy. I think one of the difficulties here is, what about if you could do it from the very beginning? If you could make a machine that would gestate an embryo right from the get-go so that that baby was never inside a woman's body, never in her uterus, but just you produce the embryos en masse through the kind of reproductive technologies that we now have occurring in our country as commercial ventures, and then these embryos are placed into bottles, as it were, sophisticated bottles, and you have a baby in a bottle, and you develop that way, never knowing your own mom. I think that's something that raises very real and very serious ethical concerns. And I think it's a direction we don't want to be going. And, you know, I think very often people will say, well, we have hundreds of thousands, maybe even now millions of frozen embryos that are trapped. Wouldn't this be a way to help save them? I'm not sure that step actually would be ethical. I think when a pregnancy fails to go to term and you're rescuing the child, that is something distinct from setting up the entire project of manhandling and manipulating human life from the get-go, conception all the way through, and treating it as a product to be marketed to the highest bidder, as it were. That's certainly going to have all kinds of ethical objectionability.
Okay, Mijov.
Yeah, I mean, but in addition to that, since we know how we humans are, sometimes, you know, somebody would say, why would I need to wait all 40 weeks to start
right.
eating what I want, drinking what I want? What if I can do it, just move baby to machine at 12 weeks? And right. that's what makes my whole thing bad. That's
yes,
what, I, mean, that's
yes
what,
I think that's a fair question, and I do think there would be temptations of that kind. And I think the temptation to step out of a pregnancy for trivial reasons would have to be, again, something that we recognize as not being morally sound, not good for the child, not good for the mother, that there's great importance to having a full gestation to the extent that that's possible. I mean, if there's genuine medical reasons that one isn't able to continue the pregnancy because maybe both the mother and the child will die, and you could use a machine to rescue both of them, well, that's a different case. But I think you're suggesting, you know, I have an interest in going on a skiing trip here fairly soon, so let me deliver at only, you know, 4 months of the pregnancy instead of 9. that would certainly be an area of significant moral concern and would not be something that could be, you know, counseled as advisable or acceptable.
Thank you very, very much for that call. There are lots of calls, so we're going to keep moving. I think there is something to what he just said about we humans being what we are. These wonderful technologies are developed, but you know that we're going to misuse them. I guess that's not an argument not to develop them, but it's an argument for something.
Right. I think you're right on that. It's very powerful, very alluring, these new technologies. And unless we really have a very well-developed sense of ethics and we're pursuing ethics with an intensity and with the guidance of Holy Mother Church, we're likely to go off into some dark alley very, very quickly.
You should start some kind of institute or something that does that, some kind of like a center where people could go to for that kind of thinking.
A great point. Something right. Like a National Catholic Bioethics Center, huh?
Exactly. Why we think alike. Marcia in Indiana, listening on Redeemer Radio, you are up next. Your question for Father Tad Boholcik.
Yes, good afternoon. Back in the 1980s, I remember listening to a program, Focus on the Family, with Dr. Jim Dobson, and he had a guest one time, Dr. Archibald Hart, who was, I think, a psychology professor at Fuller Seminary in California. And he brought up a point, they were talking about homosexuality, and he brought up a point that there's a time during a pregnancy that there will be a hormonal wash that comes over if the woman is carrying a male, that it would separate the two sides of the brain, that the female brain operates cross and both sides, and the male brain operates distinctly right or left. And he was saying that perhaps if a woman was in a very stressful situation, it could interrupt that, and that could maybe be an answer for maybe that the male brain would function more like a female brain. If Father Tad has ever heard of anything like this.
Okay, Father.
Yeah, I must say, Marcia, that is not something I have ever run into, and you mentioned Archibald Hart. I'm not familiar with that line of research. I can certainly confirm that there is a time during the development of a human in the uterus when there are significant effects of hormones, and in particular of testosterone, and these are called as a class androgens, and there is a great androgen sensitivity that will then sort of force the development of the male phenotype, the male profile, in a number of different directions in terms of the body, the brain, etc. So that you're referring to the wash of the hormones, if that's what he is referring to, this exquisite sensitivity to certain triggers that happen during development so that an embryo goes one direction or the other, that certainly is true. That has been verified. But the details of the left brain, right brain that you mention, or using both sides, I have not seen that research. And I would be actually myself, you know, as coming from a neurological background, I would be surprised if it was that simple. You know, the brain functions tend not to divide out so cleanly as that. It tends to be, you know, more focused in particular loci within the brain, and sometimes at levels that are not easy to identify with clarity.
Marcia, thank you very, very much. I hope that was helpful. I just want to, before we have to go to a break, Father, Pam in Massachusetts called us, and I imagine she didn't want to go on the air, but I imagine other people might have had the same concern. We were talking about cloning, and you were talking about how a cloned human is essentially an identical twin, but she never heard us say that Catholics are not supposed to participate in cloning. And so could you just clarify, I mean, certainly any cloned person is the equal of any other person, but what about whether we're supposed to participate in cloning?
Yes, very clearly we should not participate in that kind of technology. And that is because what we're doing is reducing procreation to a kind of manufacturing process. We are meant to be loved into being in the marital embrace, not manufactured through nuclear transfer or other technologies like in vitro fertilization, etc., where this becomes something that we pay other people to do on our behalf. That is always going to be a failure to respect the human dignity of each new person who comes into the world if we don't respect their origins and how they arise. So clearly this is something, cloning, human cloning, that Catholics should not be involved in any research connected to that.
Pam, thanks for calling us for that clarification. Do appreciate it. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Bioethics with Father Tad Poholcik right after this.
Call us now with your question. Hello? On Catholic Answers Live.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I said to the sisters one day, what do you think you're going to look like in heaven? Oh, some of them had absolutely magnificent ideas. I didn't think of one of them. And so I got desperate because then my turn came. I didn't know what to say. And so in desperation, I said, what do you think I'll wear in heaven? And they all said with one voice, armor!
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Father Tad Poholcik, our guest. Our topic is bioethics. Lots of great diversity today in the questions regarding bioethics, and we're happy to take them. If you've got one that you haven't heard yet, you're welcome to call with your question, 888-318-7884. We go now to Rasa in Michigan, listening on Ave Maria Radio. Rasa, your question for Father Tad Poholcik.
Hi, Father. I wanted to ask you, what would be the proper disposition of frozen embryos? Do we need to baptize them? What would be the Christian way to, if somebody does a mistake, what should be done regarding frozen embryos?
Yes, good question. The problem of baptizing embryos, it has an appealing sound to it. We all believe in the importance of baptism, and our Lord stressed how important it is for us to do this. But the problem is, when you are a frozen embryo, if you pour water onto that frozen embryo, you thaw the embryo, and the embryo is not able actually to survive in a strict water environment. There's a problem with the salt balances and what we refer to as the osmolarity. And you will actually cause great harm, maybe lethal harm, to that embryo by doing a baptism and thawing out the embryo by the process of baptism. So I don't think it would be correct to say that the Church wants us to baptize the embryos, because there's not actually a practical way to do that without causing their demise. So what can be done with the frozen embryos? This is actually a hugely practical question. I've had situations where people come and they say, you know, my husband and I, we have five embryos, or we have seven embryos in the deep freeze, and we did IVF many years ago. We now regret that we did it, but now I'm past childbearing age myself, and I'm wondering what to do with all of them. And there's not a clean and easy answer here. It's an awkward question, and I'm afraid I can only give you somewhat awkward answers, one of which is that there is no clear teaching at the moment from the Church regarding the question of what we call embryo adoption. So if the sister of say this woman who I'm hypothetically describing was to show up and say, how about if you give me your embryos and I'll implant them and gestate them and raise them as if they were my own children? There are concerns around that, that that's a type of surrogacy. There are other issues that maybe we won't get into the details, but the church has not addressed that question and definitively said that it's okay or it's not okay. But the language that the church has used thus far has been moving in the direction of saying that this is not something that should be done. The most recent document was called Dignitas Personae, and you can look it up on the Vatican's website, and I think it's section 19 they deal with that. So what about the family that has these embryos? Sometimes when couples come to me, one piece of advice I'll give them, and again, this is part of the kind of awkwardness of it, I'll say, if I were in your situation and I had a group of frozen children, I would feel I at least have a duty to maybe set up a trust fund to pay the company that is keeping them frozen in the liquid nitrogen so that if I die, you know, a month or two from now, my embryos won't be orphans and there will be a trust fund and at least they can. It's a way of me showing my concern for my children, even though I realize this isn't going to be able to be done permanently or forever, but it's a sign of my goodwill and my regret. And I'm trying to care for my children who happen to be frozen, even though this is a rather awkward way of doing it. It's one of the only ways available. So I do have, you know, people who have come to me and said, yeah, that's probably the best I can do at the moment to show my goodwill towards my children. And they set up those trust funds with some money in it to care for their children. So there's no easy answer here. We can't thaw out the embryos because when we thaw them out, there's about a 50% rate of attrition, loss of those embryos, and it appears that the thawing process, freeze-thaw cycles, cause death for a large number of them. And, you know, apart from that, there really aren't any other clear solutions. So it's an important reminder to us how the church is teaching about not doing in vitro fertilization, that there's great wisdom there, and couples sometimes ignore this. And unfortunately, sometimes even priests will give bad advice here and say to couples, well, if you really, you know, want to do it and you're struggling with infertility, then go ahead. But no, that's something we should never do. We should never choose in vitro. And this is one of the reasons, one of the varied reasons. There are several other reasons as well that we should not be creating our children in glassware. That's always going to lead to grave, grave concerns and problems like this.
Rasa, we will leave it there because there are lots of folks who want to talk with Father Tad. I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you so much for the call. Anne-Marie in Connecticut, listening on the EWTN app. Anne-Marie, your question for Father.
Yes, I'm wondering, is there any research being done to determine if there's a link between women's use of synthetic hormones, contraceptives, and possibly that youth contributing to things like transgenderism or same-sex attraction in future generations? How can these chemicals not biologically affect the 6 to 7 million eggs a woman carries, which become her future children, and then those children have children, and contraceptives have been around, 50, 60 years now? Are we seeing the effects of this?
All right, Anne-Marie. Great question, Father.
Yeah, Anne-Marie, I have not seen well-done studies that would address this. I mean, I haven't seen studies on this topic at all. It doesn't mean that they're not out there, but this has not come across my radar in the specific form that you're mentioning. I have had other Catholics ask this question, raise this concern. And I think part of what's behind it is the recognition that many of the hormonal contraceptives that women take, they are very powerful agents. The fact that you can, you know, disrupt a woman's fertility by means of contraception, then they theorize, well, then there could be other related effects, maybe in terms of a transgender direction. But I have not seen any data that would scientifically establish that connection. But let me just throw out another angle here that I think connects very directly to your question, which is that I think when we realize what contraception does, kind of in a broad societal sense, contraception makes females into what? Into infertile images of males. It, in effect, contraception neuters a woman. It neutralizes her femininity. So what contraception does is it diminishes the unique importance and value of women specifically as mothers. It says, hey, this isn't so important. We can just neglect that. So what happens? Gender roles become fundamentally blurred. And I'm convinced that the widespread deployment of contraception in our society is certainly connected in some way to the creation of the broader gender confusion that we are now seeing, because these gender roles are being twisted and torqued and reshaped by the widespread acceptance of a contraceptive mentality. So that's not maybe the chemical link that you were looking for, but I think it's certainly a kind of ideological or broader societal link that is present and operative in the way that our society approaches the gender issues.
Very interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Thank you, Father.
Anne-Marie, thank you very, very much. I do think we have time for some more, so let me move on. Anne-Marie, thank you again. Let's go to James in Allendale, Michigan, listening on Holy Family Radio. James, could you be a little bit quick with your question to give Father time to answer?
Yes. I'm wondering, in regards to treating and evaluating for sexual dysfunction in unmarried people, is that ever illicit, knowing that it might likely be used for sin if you're not necessarily evaluating and treating the cause of it itself, but maybe underlying hormonal issues or cardiovascular disease?
Okay, so James, that's a little bit complicated. Are you asking for the case of male infertility in particular, what can be done?
Or do you mean impotence rather than infertility?
Impotence rather than infertility, but I guess it applies to both male and female sexual dysfunction.
Okay, because I think, and when you ask for a single man, it does get a little bit more tricky when one's dealing with questions of infertility. The question of impotence itself, for example, Viagra in a married situation is not going to raise fundamental moral concerns. I think when you take that out of the setting of marital intimacy, and use something like Viagra in other settings, there definitely could be ethical concerns that would arise. The question, if we shift over from impotence to infertility, if you're trying to figure out what's causing male factor infertility and how does one procure a semen sample, that kind of question, that requires also some great care. And one can, in a married situation, use a perforated silastic sheath, as they call it, which is basically a perforated condom with no spermicide. And during marital relations, sample passes through, but some is retained, and then you could test whether the sperm has proper motility, whether the number of sperm is decreased, and maybe get at a cause of the infertility of the couple. But for a single man, that approach, of course, could not be utilized. So it's important to kind of specify precisely the scenario that one's considering, and there will be clearly ethical limits on what one can do in making some of these assessments.
Thank you, James. I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you very much, Father Tad Boholcik, for a very fine hour. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. Great to be with you, as always.
Father, may we have your blessing before we go?
Absolutely. May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen. Amen. You can find Father Tad at the National Catholic Bioethics Center. You can find it on the web address is NC. Wait, you, Father, you do it.
It's ncbcenter.org.
ncbcenter.org. I appreciate it. Coming up next, Carla Broussard will be here. We're going to talk about truth and tolerance. You know you're supposed to be tolerant. Everywhere in society, you're told that. But what is the role of truth in living out the call to be tolerant? Next with Carla.